I apologize if the sound quality is a little bit off. I'm in a hospital this week, a couple of days tending to someone who was ill. I just wanted to record a few Rashis for Parshas Matos and Maaseh. Parshas Maaseh describes the journey from Mitzrayim to Eretz Yisrael, and then ultimately the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael and the mechanics for distribution and how to settle the land. Very famous machlokas between the Rambam and the Ramban, whether there's actually a formal mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael. But the first part of the journey, the departure point, was Ramses. And the Torah makes special mention of the fact that they left with a pride and a komemios, as we would say in the modern context. And the Torah quickly adds that the Egyptians were burying their dead because they had suffered not just material loss, but psychologically devastating loss, as Isa Shahika, Hashem Bahem Kol Bechor, Uve Elohehem Asa Hashem Shvatim. And it wasn't just the devastation towards the Bechor, but the gods themselves were overwhelmed by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Rashi comments that this was the reason that the Jewish people emerged with such pride, because the Egyptians were just too busy burying their dead. Rashi has two words, Terudim be'evlam. They were busy. Again, they could have been busy practically and just digging graves, embalming bodies, made them less attentive to the Jewish departure. Or, quite honestly, there's an additional component. They were just devastated spiritually and psychologically, especially because it affected both the firstborn, which were seen as parent nobility, and then their gods themselves had been smitten or suffering, whatever manifestations or representations of their gods had been smitten by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now, what's fascinating is that Rashi is, of course, highlighting the textual anomaly that the Torah is meant to count encampments, not the story of the Eser Makos. So Rashi has to try to find some association and some linkage, and the linkage is that the Jews could exit Ramses with a Yad Rama, with pride and triumph and confidence and power, because the Egyptians were busy. This is very odd. It's very odd in light of the Eser Makos. The Eser Makos were so overwhelming in their force, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to break the will of the Egyptians, that it may have seemed more triumphant for the Egyptians to oppose them in Mitzrayim and for the Jews to simply march out involuntarily to the Egyptians against their will, not because they were sidetracked or they were preoccupied with their dead or with the psychological recovery from their suffering. So it's very strange that HaKadosh Baruch Hu sets the wheels in motion, creates a mechanism for diverting the Egyptian interests so that the Jews can achieve the type of pride they'll need ultimately to receive the Torah, to mature religiously, to conquer Eretz Yisrael. And Rashi, in a sense, frames the question, puts it into sharp relief. Why does HaKadosh Baruch Hu create this, that's what I'm looking for, this alternate reason, this plot line, so the Jews are able to achieve their pride because the Egyptians are burying their dead? I think part of it is HaKadosh Baruch Hu is teaching Am Yisrael a lesson, that sometimes redemption will be supernatural and hover above history and impose itself on history. But more often, redemption and Geula will course through historical events, and we will have to decode political and historical events, which appear to be normal, which appear to be driven by other dynamics other than HaKadosh Baruch Hu's redemptive trajectory and redemptive plan. We'll have to decode these events and be able to trace him back to the divine authorship. To the bystander who just enters this scene on that day that they leave Sukkot or Ramses on the 15th, it just seems as if it's circumstance and serendipitous. The Egyptians are busy and the Jews can walk out with their pride. But contextualizing and framing the entire sequence of events, the reason the Egyptians were so busy is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created realities and causes that preoccupied their interests, so that the Jewish people, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu chooses sometimes to work through history and through the process of politics and geopolitics. And that pretty much is a lesson that becomes accentuated during Makas Bacharis and its aftermath. And this is very much the aftermath, it's the day after. Because keep in mind, the night before, there was a civil war in Egypt that led to tens of thousands of deaths because the firstborns or the firstborn rioted, urging Paro to release the Jewish people because now they had skin in the race. They're next war on the line, and Paro refuses, and this leads to civil unrest, which ultimately mushrooms into a civil war, and the Bechors are rampaging through Egypt, killing off their warlords or their aristocratic lords who refuse to let the Jewish people be released, or Paro's inner court. And then, of course, the second part of Makas Bechoros is HaKadosh Baruch Hu descending and supernaturally eliminating the Bechors, who had been at first the authors of Makas Bechoros and delivering death to their countrymen, and then were the victims of Makas Bechoros. So this night and this day together was a lesson that hadn't really been delivered too powerfully beforehand, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's redemption sometimes operates through nature, not to be superimposed upon nature. And to a degree, this may have been, I think Rav Amital used to speak about this, this may have been Moshe's frustration in the beginning of Sefer Shemos, when he expects the Gula to be immediate and riding upon clouds, as we would say, and superior to the world of political events. And Hashem says, go back to Paro and convince him and struggle with him and persuade him. And it's hard to know why HaKadosh Baruch Hu sometimes chooses to stream Gula through historical conduits, but it's clear that we're living through a similar experience and events that could be simply attributed to global political trends and national developments, and certainly the acceleration of nature over the last couple hundreds of years. And this, of course, leads to another Rashi, related Rashi. Rashi speaks about the Pasuk, which describes the Torah prefaces its description of the map of Israel with a very strange word. Zos haaretz asher tipol lachem benachala. So Rashi's first interpretation is the word tipol reflects the, so to speak, randomness of the goral. It just falls to you rather than something you achieve or build or seize. It fell to the various tribes. Our image is something falling from heaven. If, let's say, something, some gold falls in your path or falls from heaven, it at least has the sense of randomness rather than determine or deliberately mining for gold in a particular area. So the lands fell to the various Shevatim because the Goral, at least, of course, there was all Ruach HaKodesh, but from their standpoint, they had no authorship or they couldn't dictate which lands they received. Then Rashi quotes a Medrash. Ayidei shehipil HaKadosh Baruch Hu sarayim shel sheva umos min hashamayim. HaKadosh Baruch Hu defeated, reduced, set down, hipil, sarayim, the angelic representatives of the seven nations, the kaftan lefnei Moshe, and he tied them in front of Moshe. Amar lo ra'ei ein b'hem od koach. HaKadosh Baruch Hu literally reduced, was mapil, brought down a few notches, diminished the power of, degraded. Now, of course, these are metaphysical forces that Chazal often speak about, that each nation has a representative in the cosmos, in the upper heavens, that supervises its ark and that is the deliverer and the proxy in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And certainly these are not the types of ideas that in the modern context we typically have currency with. Certainly in the days of Moshe Rabbeinu, in a more spiritual, metaphysical reality, heavenly bodies were something that, of course, Moshe Rabbeinu interacted freely with, and presumably multiple nations were quite conscious of their heavenly bodies or metaphysical entities. And these entities were ransacked by HaKadosh Baruch Hu and placed at Moshe's behest. If we modernize and update this Rashi to 2018 in terms of the way that we think and that we process, not to say that the metaphysics isn't as true in 2018 as it was then, but we just suddenly don't have currency or have discourse in those types of ideas, so just repeating them is less meaningful. If we simply translate the angelic representative or the celestial representative, the Sarah Umos, from a particular angel or person to just historical trends and and patterns that govern the emergence of nations. And of course, each nation has its own specific ethnicity and location and genetic disposition to a degree. And then there are some general political patterns and societal evolutionary and anthropological patterns that govern every nation. And essentially, just as HaKadosh Baruch Hu takes the ancient angel of each nation of the world of antiquity and reduces their authority and subjects them to Moshe's authority, to the Jewish people's march into Eretz Yisrael, they're no longer going to be as powerful as they were. In our day, HaKadosh Baruch Hu literally ransacks historical trajectories in order to enable the Jewish people to return to Eretz Yisrael. And said otherwise, we can expect there to be a lot of tumult and chaos and historical irregularity enabling the Jewish return. So just like the angels in the days of Moshe could no longer assert the classic dynamics and processes and needs of their respective countries because the Jews were entering Eretz Israel. Similarly, when the Jews returned to Eretz Israel, we'd expect politics and anthropology and culture to be deviant as HaKadosh Baruch Hu enables the Jewish return. And I think we sense that in the very, very rapid succession of empires in the days of Koresh and Nebuchadnezzar and the cultural shifts and the acceleration of cultural changes, which is so evident in Megillas Esther, and of empire shifts from Nebuchadnezzar to Koresh to the Parsim to the Medians to the Madaim. And similarly, I think we find over the last 150 years the rapid change in the development of both human politics and even more so of human society and human experience. It's hard to freeze the redemptive process in midstream and try to take stock of its achievements, but we certainly sense that the emergence of technology and the way in which technology has altered our world, at least at this point in 2018, seems to be favoring the Jewish return and the emergence of the development of the Jewish state as a superpower in technology and all the spin-off benefits of that engagement. So taking a Rashi, which seems very remote and seems to speak in a very foreign, antiquated language, it's simply understanding the modular structure of Rashi and then updating it for our own current scene and our own current reality. Finally, there's a Rashi, again about Eretz Yisrael. After the Torah employs the verb tipol, lachem benachala, the Torah stresses Eretz kina ligivulo seha. The boundaries are very, very determined and distinct. If you were to ask someone why the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael are necessary and why they are meant to be distinct, it's for a range of reasons. You know, where the Jews are meant to settle, as we say, the Promised Land, the land of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the land of Jewish sovereignty, the land of Jewish expansion, of Jewish culture. It's a obvious, self-evident need and an obvious, self-evident cartographical or geographical entity. And yet Rashi feels compelled to explain why these boundaries are necessary and for which purpose these boundaries are decisive or functional. Rashi writes, Lefi shaharbe mitzvos nahagos baretz. Because there are a whole range of mitzvos that apply in Eretz Yisrael, which we refer to as mitzvos hataluyos baretz, primarily the agricultural mitzvos of trumos and maisos, but many as well, shemitah, part of the agricultural, korbanos, other aspects of halach in Eretz Yisrael. Hutzvecha kasav lichtov mitzrone gvul rechosa. The Torah therefore has to describe the boundaries in order to teach us which areas have halachic significance and which areas don't have halachic application, and the laws of Trumas and Maisos may not apply, or may only apply midrabanan. And of course, throughout history, this became an important question: how to define the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael for mitzvos, based at least initially upon the boundaries described in Parshas Maaseh. But I think in Rashi, by implication, michlal lav atashomei hen, michlal hen atashomei lav. By induction, it appears that Rashi is limiting these boundaries and the rigidity of these boundaries to mitzvos. When it comes to determining Eretz Yisrael as and the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael for the mitzvos, which are limited to Eretz Yisrael, and the boundaries are pretty clear and forthright. And they depend upon the initial entry as described in Maaseh, and perhaps subsequent entries that can install Eretz Yisrael with the requisite Kedusha to obligate certain mitzvahs or to prohibit certain items. But what about Eretz Yisrael in other terms? What about the status of the land of Israel? Even if it's bereft of the halacha kedusha because it isn't stipulated in these boundaries and because Jews settle there without the tools of conferring halachic status. This is something which many have spoken about in halachic literature. One of my rebbeim, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, in his description of a Gemara on Daf Tes and Maseches Gittin, spoke about two different definitions of Israel. One is the halachic Israel, and one is a general status of Israel for certain applications described in the Gemara and Gittin, in particular technicalities about composing a bill of divorce, a get. But even outside of halachic literature, this Rashi provides the capacity to extrapolate a very different image of Eretz Yisrael, even if it isn't considered halachically Eretz Yisrael. So, for example, there are a lot of conversations in today's, again, halachic sphere about Eilat, or about areas which may not fall within the biblical boundaries of Eretz Yisrael, but have been settled in the modern state by the Jewish people. Should they be part of Israel? Well, they may not have halachic status for Shemitah, and for many, this was an interesting option during the years of Shemitah when we still lived in Gaza, which is clearly outside of some of these boundaries, to consume some of the Gaza-based or Gaza-based fruit and produce and thereby elude some of the concerns and complications of Shemitah. But certainly everyone would believe, and this isn't a political statement, that if the Jews settle Gaza, then and they establish their sovereignty, which unfortunately we weren't able to establish more than about 40 years or so, but we are able to establish its sovereignty, and then it becomes part of the land of Israel, the land of the Jews, even if it doesn't contain the halachic. Namely, we can't use a purely halachic gauge to determine boundaries of Eretz Yisrael, and the boundaries stated within the halachic system outlined in Parshas Maaseh dictate the halachic range and surface area of Eretz Yisrael. But that's not the only identity of Eretz Yisrael, and Rashi is very quick to delimit these boundaries, which are set in stone regardless of Jewish settlement and regardless of Jewish expansion, apply to the halachic boundaries. But there could be status of Eretz Yisrael, which isn't limited or in any way pivoted upon halacha. Shabbat Shalom.